If you are a first-time prospective home buyer, what do you do in these two hot markets? Ben, please give everyone
that's
the
a
answer.
Terrible question. Let me gaze into my crystal ball for a minute.
Welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee, and on the show today, I'll be talking to Ben Rabideau of North Cove Advisors, a market research firm specializing in Canadian macroeconomics, housing, and credit trends. Ben provides research to, among other people, institutional investors in the United States who are looking for information on those topics. Now, before I introduce Ben, a big thank you to the listeners who left star ratings on iTunes. And also a few listeners left some comments. So I don't know how to pronounce this this name. I think it's either Serve in Ought or Senior Vigneault. I have no idea, but he's been listening, or she has been listening for years. And I want to thank you for that, especially since there was pretty much a year and a half there where there were no episodes published. And also Matt MNV is a new listener and is also a business student. So I'm glad you found us and I hope you enjoy today's show. If you haven't done so yet, I really do appreciate you taking 5 seconds to leave a rating on iTunes. And if you want to take the additional time to write in a comment on top of that, I do read them all. And now on to today's guest, a good friend of mine, a friend of the show, Ben Rabideau, who is an expert on Canadian macroeconomics, as I said, housing and credit trends. You've likely seen or heard him in various media outlets because he's high in demand. The Globe and Mail, BNN, CTV, and perhaps most notably on this very podcast.
Most notably.
Yeah. Although years ago. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, man. It's good to be back.
So, hey, let's just dig right into it. Are we in a housing bubble?
don't waste any time. Right?
No, and it's like no wine. It's like straight to the business.
Yeah, that's the question I get asked the most. I mean, look, it's first of all, there's no Canadian housing market. So,
right.
So, you know, you got to be careful on that one. And the regional dynamics are obviously hugely different. We really, at this point in time, we have two regions that are driving all the headline gains. So you've got basically the Lower Mainland in BC. Mm-hmm. That's not even true. Even you get over to the island, I mean, it's, you get major strength in BC, we'll say.
Right. Because now Southern people Ontario. Are fleeing downtown Vancouver, say, I'm going to Victoria where all the old people are.
Exactly. Well, Victoria was quite weak for a number of years.
Right.
Right. And it's really refound its footing.
Right.
And so you've got obviously tremendous strength there.
Mm-hmm.
You've got tremendous strength Southern Ontario. And then you get outside of that. I mean, I think everyone understands what's happening on the prairies is largely resource commodity driven.
Right.
But I think what a lot of people miss is just how weak Eastern Northern Ontario are. Again, relatively speaking, they're certainly not frothy like we see in Southern Ontario. And then you get over into Quebec and into the Maritimes. It's certainly not a booming market out there. So, I mean, look. I'm always uneasy with that question. I mean,
I absolutely, so I just wanted to turn it around on you.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Look, here's my view on it. There's certain dynamics that are unsustainable. And so by definition, they're going to end. Mm-hmm. And the question is simply, what does that look like when it ends? And
right.
So in Canada, you know, what I see is, you know, I think the story on consumer debt, household leverage is well understood.
Mm-hmm.
I think less understood is the degree to which the economy and the labor market are benefiting from a strong housing market. So
right.
You get this incredible second derivative in. So a great example is last quarter we had residential investment in Canada, which is new housing construction plus renovation and then the commissions paid on transactions.
Right. Okay,
you throw that all together, that's what we call residential investment. That set a brand new record as a percentage of GDP, all-time high.
Wow.
And so when you think about it, and so when you back that series out over the last 30 or 40 years, you can see these notable peaks and troughs where it, you know, it gets as high as kind of 7% back in the late 70s,
mm-hmm.
hits kind of high 6% in the late 80s. Both of those periods were marked by sharp, sharp adjustments downwards in real estate,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it was clear in hindsight that the economy had grown too levered to that boom.
Right.
There was a softening in the market, to put it mildly. And there was tremendous fallout in the labor market. And it's pro-cyclical, right? So a strong housing market creates jobs because people feel wealthy. They spend. Yep. We see retail sales at record high. We see auto sales at record highs.
Oh, man, we could talk a lot about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure you'd love to. Yeah. And then consequently, that in turn creates new jobs, which creates housing demand, et cetera. And so there's this virtuous cycle.
Right.
There are some noted economists that would say that the business cycle is in fact the housing cycle.
Right.
It's that important to the economy. And so, you know, when you get this laid into a boom like what we've had in Canada, the unwind, and again, it's, you know, for some of your listeners who have never seen a cycle in real estate, it's important that they remember that this is a cyclical industry.
Yeah, that's
right. It doesn't feel like it when you're
grown up and they don't know that interest rates have been double digits at one point and that housing goes down.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of housing in Toronto falling 25% peak trough from 89 to 93.
Right.
You know, it's just not fathomable for a lot of these people who are listening today, right?
Right.
But that's a housing cycle.
Yeah.
And it is a cyclical industry. And so we haven't seen it. Look, the short answer to your question is, I think there's a lot of incredibly unhealthy dynamics at play.
Right.
That probably mean that at some point when this current housing cycle ends, there's going to be some nasty fallout. So you call that whatever you want. I think it's pretty safe to call that a bubble.
Right.
But look, the timing here is unknown. I would have said that, as you know, a couple of years ago. I looked at some of the dynamics then and thought it was a concern.
Too,
and here we are today. So, you know, that's not to say that something's unsustainable doesn't mean it's going to end tomorrow. Right.
Right.
And there's a lot of, as I know you want to talk about, there's a lot of other dynamics at play that could determine how this all comes about.
Yeah, and we touched on the fact that there have been a lot of people, especially I would say first-time homebuyers, mm-hmm. who have grown up in an environment where interest rates are super low. Their parents' generation have done really well with their real estate investments, so there's sort of like this moral suasion, and they have never seen an actual cycle in real estate. So they are wanting to buy it. And we've seen this long bull market in real estate, especially in these hot markets. But what's happened lately is that in the last year, those price gains have accelerated. So it's been a lot of people saying, oh, this isn't sustainable. You know, mm-hmm. you got to be careful. There's always corrections, pullbacks and whatnot. And just when you think that it is less likely for that to continue, it actually starts to increase faster. So what the hell has happened in the last year? Because I think I was reading the other day, the year-over-year increases in certain markets in Vancouver for detached homes is like 38% year-over-year or something
exactly.
like that. What is going on?
All right. Well, there's lots to unpack there. First, maybe let me just comment on this idea of you know, the older generation imparting wisdom to the younger ones. And look, it's absolutely true. You look at anybody who bought a house, even if they bought 89 at the peak of the market and they suffered devastating losses for a decade, you know, today they're laughing.
Right.
And so the message, I guess, that's become ingrained is, look, if you hold it long enough, it's going to make money. And I think that's probably true. It's true of most assets. Look, it's something in this world we call inflation, and it generally applies to, you know, most goods and services. So if you hold it long enough, it's going to go up in value. The problem is when you're dealing with a levered purchase like real estate is, where in some cases you're levered 20-1.
Yes.
It doesn't take much of a move to end up, you know, with a serious problem where you're underwater. The house that you bought as an investment, as a dream home, all of a sudden becomes an anchor. You can't move to go pursue other jobs because you're underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's one of the realities that this generation can't fathom, because that just seems so foreign to see any sort of a downturn. So now one of the dynamics that we see at play, and again, this isn't new, but again, the guys who I talked to on the front line would say that this is accelerated recently, is this dynamic of intergenerational wealth transfer.
Right.
Which, you know, on the surface sounds benign, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea here, excuse me, is that you might get a first-time buyer who gets a gifted down payment from their folks.
Right. Who did really well in real estate.
Absolutely. So they bought a house. It was, you know, $60,000 30 years ago when they bought it. It's now worth
$200 million.
$200 million. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, they either sell and downsize, or they tap the equity via a home equity line of credit or a mortgage refi. And they gift it to their kids, and it's sort of a, you know, it's sort of a tax-free endowment, and they take that and they in turn enter the real estate market. Now, and there's benefits to that. If you can get to 20% down payment, then you can avoid CMHC fees. You can extend the amortization to 35 years.
Yeah, and that's getting really hard. I mean, when you've got prices that have gone up so much, to save up enough for even a 5% down payment for a lot of people in the hot markets is tough, but 20%, pretty tough to do it on your own unless you're getting assistance.
Yeah, absolutely. And so again, there you would say, well, that seems like a healthy and normal dynamic. But what people miss is that there's an element of that that's highly reflexive and highly what we call pro-cyclical.
Yeah.
And so the idea there is as the market increases, as the value of the home increases, it actually provides the fuel for the next generation of buyers. So in other words, it's not organic, mm-hmm. right? It's somewhat, cannibalistic.
Right.
It's not sustainable.
Right.
And so if the only way that new buyers are getting into this market largely is because of wealth transfer from an older generation, that's not a good sign.
Right.
And again, that's not to say that this ends next year, but that's one of those signs that this is not a healthy market. Now, you asked what's happened in the last year that's really set things off.
Yeah.
I mean, the big story is a dramatic drop in for sale inventory. In mm-hmm. Toronto and Vancouver.
So supply.
Supply is down massively. Really, I mean, it's unbelievable when you look at Toronto and Vancouver. We look in the industry at what we call months of inventory, which is the amount of inventory for sale divided by the most recent months of sales.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as an example, if you had 100 listings in a city and there were 10 sales a month before, you'd say, okay, well, it was 100 divided by 10. There's 10 months of inventory.
Mm-hmm.
It would take 10 months to clear that inventory. And so a normal market in a place like Toronto historically might be something like 4 or 5 months of inventory. Right now we're at one.
One?
One. Over in BC, it might be something like 5 or 6 months of inventory. Historically, we're at two.
Right.
So just, I mean, these dramatic drops in inventory and then, you know, sharp increase in demand. Now, the one thing I would say about Toronto, which I've said before, is there is a legitimate lack of supply in the detached single family market.
Right.
And you can see that in the data. You look at what's under construction,
mm-hmm.
It's up fairly sharply year over year in that space, but still way lower than it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the demand's gone up. What's in the pipeline has dropped. Okay. And so what we've replaced it with instead is a lot of condos under construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some very unique dynamics in Toronto where there is a clear limitation on the amount of single family homes that can be delivered to market.
Right.
And so look, I on one hand, I would say that is an insulating factor in a downturn.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to blow this market out with supply. But at the same time, do I think this is a market that should be rising 20% year over year in perpetuity? I mean, the math just doesn't make sense.
Right.
And so you are going to run up against boundaries of affordability at some point. There's clearly a lot of froth in this market. There's clearly a lot of fear of missing out.
Yes.
FOMO, as they call it. Exactly.
Yep.
And look, that's the sort of market psychology that, you know, breeds all sorts of bad decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, look, that's a conversation we could have last year, but there's no question it's gotten frothier.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's Toronto. And again, I would parse out the single family from the condo. Clearly there are more concerns in the condo space at this point. You get over into Vancouver, it's a very different story.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are surprised to learn that single family homes under construction are at all time highs in Vancouver.
Okay.
So in spite of developers saying they have nowhere to build, they're finding place to build. Now, some of that is redevelopment of existing stock.
Okay.
Right. So there's no net gain there. They tear down a bungalow, they build a bigger house.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it's new supply. You can see that in the data. And they're at monster all-time highs for total dwellings under construction.
So their supply constraints are not as severe as Toronto, and yet they're having higher price gains.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you square that?
Well, it's not local incomes. We can say that much.
Aha. Aha. Yeah. So one of the stories for the last while has been foreign money.
Yep.
Right. So money from China. So people want to get their money out of the Chinese system for whatever reason. And they've got a lot of it. And so it's finding a home, apparently, allegedly, in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what's been going on there. Because for years now, people have been saying, well, we don't have data. We don't have the data to sort of really put our finger on how much of a problem this is, if it is one. What's been going on in terms, because there was some data released just earlier this week,
mm-hmm.
and some people are saying, interesting data, don't know if I buy that. So talk us through what this story about foreign money and the data collection.
Sure. And I guess first I would say that you know, people who have seen my work for a while would know that I pushed back pretty hard on this narrative at one point in the past. So I was one of those people that said, listen, you know, I don't buy that this is a foreign capital problem because I can't find that in the data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, eventually you get to the point where the anecdotes, and look, I understand, look, there's a saying, in research that the plural of anecdotes is not data. So you can never build a thesis on just anecdotes. But there comes a point where the anecdotes are so compelling and so uniform across the industry that you have to go, wait a minute, there's something here, right? And when it comes to that foreign capital issue, that's definitely the case. Look, no one has hard data on this. It's a highly opaque market, very much by design, because the people oftentimes looking to get their capital here don't want it particularly easy to trace.
Right.
But look, I mean, the data that came out from the province of BC, and maybe for background for your listeners, they took a 3-week period of time.
A whole three weeks.
well, whatever. I mean, it is what it is. And they had disclosure from the purchasers via their lawyers in terms of who, you know, their residency. And from that, they determined that, in Vancouver's roughly 5% of buyers are foreigners.
Okay.
Now what they also found is that the typical foreign buyer tends to purchase at a much higher price point, which we know.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say we know, but which the anecdote strongly suggests. Right. And so, you know, maybe 5% of sales, but that could be 10%, 15% of dollar volume. Mm-hmm. So that's still a big number. Now, I think what wasn't captured is just as important. And so if you do any digging with realtors in Toronto or Vancouver, one thing that you find is there are many instances where the buyer is local, but the capital backing them is foreign.
Right.
And so an example might be a student who's here on a student visa. Mm-hmm. Technically not a foreigner, but you know, again, the anecdotes here are so compelling that you can't ignore them, that there's a number of these types of straw buyers. And it could be something like just a relative that lives here that has permanent residency, but the capital backing them is coming out of China or wherever.
There is an Instagram account of the UBC parking lot, and it's nothing but Lamborghinis, Ferraris, Aston Martins, you name it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the student lot. It wasn't the faculty lot.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a story of, you know, a student who's living in a $31 million house in Vancouver. Like, do we really think this is a local buyer with local income? I mean, come on. So, and again, that doesn't get captured in the data.
Right.
And, also not captured in the data is numbered corporations. So, I mean, if you're a foreigner looking to move illicit capital,
right,
you're probably not buying in your own name, because you fear repercussions. You know, there's just been a case where a Chinese bank has tried to sue a Vancouver resident, former resident of China, who's basically a fugitive.
Yeah, I saw that.
And they're trying to sue them for illicit capital that was taken out of the country. So, you know, that's an example of a person who wasn't very clever about it, but they should. If you want to be clever about it, you put it in a numbered corporation. And so, right, of course, that's not captured in the data as well. So, look, yeah. I'm not one of those people, you know, I don't dismiss the data because it, you know, doesn't confirm my bias. Again, I was one of those people who said this foreign buyer story is overstated. Mm-hmm. I said that multiple times. I think I was wrong on that. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can't ignore the overwhelming evidence, albeit anecdotal, that this is a very serious part of this market.
Anecdata.
That's right.
All right. So obviously, if you're Canadian, you've probably heard multiple stories about real estate in these hot markets. If you're a first-time home buyer, this is something that weighs on you. And it's now become something that is in the domain of policy. So now it's been elevated to the point where policymakers are seriously debating, what do we do about this? And the city of Vancouver was just given permission by the provincial government in BC to enact a vacant home tax. So tell us what that is and whether or not you think that's going to have an effect.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Well, we don't know what it's going to be.
Right. So we're speculating at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And the mechanics there. I mean, it's going to be It's going to be difficult to implement. I mean, what is a vacant home? Is somebody who is a snowbird and is out of the country for 6 months of the year, is that a vacant home? I mean, the actual, the real world realities of implementing a tax like that are going to make it quite challenging, but
tough to enforce. Yeah,
it's going to be tough to enforce. But I think the bigger story is the message it sends. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's followed this story out in Vancouver can see that the political winds have shifted dramatically in the last 6 months.
Right.
I mean, I wrote about this late last year to my clients when I did kind of the 2016 outlook. And that was one of the things that we were sensing at the beginning, is that you could sense the beginning of a significant shift in public sentiment towards mm-hmm. foreign investment.
Yeah.
And it was meaningful enough that I thought at that time that it was probably a 50-50 chance that we saw some sort of reactive policy at some level of government aimed at restricting foreign capital. And what I thought was likely was some sort of Australia style restriction, and where, you know, we force foreign buyers to purchase new, but they can't absorb existing housing stock and hold it off market, right, or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what we've seen out of Vancouver is kind of the first example of that sort of reactionary policy.
Has the drop in oil, which translated into this precipitous decline in the loonie about, I guess it's 18 months now.
Yeah.
Is that partly responsible for the acceleration in prices? Because now if you have foreign money, it's worth, you know, 10, 20% more over the span of 6 months. Would that have an effect as well? Or is it too tough to get that data?
It doesn't hurt.
Certainly,
I mean,
look,
I think the people who are most anxious to get their money here are somewhat price insensitive.
Right.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, if it's a choice between potentially losing all your life savings to a communist government one day.
Or 20% because you buy it the wrong time.
Right.
Like, yeah, I'll take that all day long.
Exactly. So yeah. I mean, look, I don't think it's going to make a difference for them. Does it affect kind of the marginal foreign investor who might be, you know, some rich American or something like that?
Right.
They're maybe a bit more price sensitive. Yeah, it certainly helps at the margin.
But now it's become a policy issue because it certainly affects the domestic buyer.
Without a doubt. To the extent that the units are held off market.
Right.
Without a doubt. And so that's where, look, I think the idea of, you know, some sort of a tax on speculation or vacant home, I think it makes sense. It's just the realities in that. Look, I'm not a policy wonk. I don't know the answer on this, but something along those lines where we try to encourage investors to lease those units out and put them back in the rental market. I mean, it's hard for me to argue against that. I think that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. One of the other suggestions, and actually I was just watching, I was flipping through channels and I saw Joe Oliver was talking. He was asked the question about housing and he threw in his answer that one of the things that they could do was take a look at raising the down payment requirements as well as, being tighter with credit. But the first part of that, raising the down payment requirements.
Terrible idea.
I wasn't going to say, you know, would that work or not? I'm just going to ask how out to lunch is that suggestion?
That's a terrible idea. I mean, look, if you believe, well, let me put it this way. All of the parts of the country where it's almost exclusively a domestic bid.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Maritimes, Quebec, outside of Montreal, very few foreign investors in rural Quebec.
They would be saying, what the hell are you doing?
Right. Right.
What have I done to piss you off that you would do this to us?
Right, right, right. You get, you know, Northern Eastern Ontario, you know, all of those places that we talked about, these are not booming markets.
Right.
Right. These are markets that are actually showing a lot of signs of fatigue barely flat price-wise.
Right.
In a lot of these markets. So to me, again, the only two areas that are really showing strength are Southern Ontario and BC. And curiously enough, those are the areas that no one disputes are receiving outsized capital flows from offshore.
Right.
So what's it going to matter? You raise the down payment to 10% across the board and the guy from China goes, that doesn't matter to me. I'm paying cash. Right? Right. It just doesn't matter. I'm going to get a loan for 50% loan to value.
So it seems like the exact wrong policy response if you're trying to placate the electorate.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, I've been an advocate for a while that one thing that CMHC should do is re-implement the regional mortgage cap.
And so explain, yeah. So yeah, we've talked about this. So explain for our listeners, what is the regional mortgage cap?
Sure. And let me also say that I think that what they did with the sliding scale on the down payment rule change that came out in effect earlier this year, I think that actually wasn't a bad policy. I think that makes sense. Now, it did nothing to dent the market because, again, it's a market where those buyers at the margins are not price sensitive. And they're not sensitive to changing the down payment, right? If you look at Toronto, just as an example, you know, the last month, so for June, home sales were up about 7% year over year. But mm-hmm. if you parse that data and you look at like the $3 million segment and the $2 million segment, the gain in sales in those segments, it was 80-90% year over year.
Right.
So outsized gains in those segments. Well, those are exempt from those,
right.
from those down payment rules, right? Because yeah. you're talking only insured mortgages in this case, and mortgage insurance doesn't count once you get over $1 million. So, I think that that policy change made some sense. Look, the regional mortgage cap was in effect until 2003. And so basically the way that it worked is if you lived in a more expensive market like Toronto, then maybe you could get insurance on a mortgage, but the purchase price was capped at something like $250,000. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're in a less expensive market, like let's say a Saskatoon, $250,000 buys you a lot of house back then. And so it was capped instead at $100,000. This is a system that's worked quite well in the US for a number of years where they have mortgage insurance restrictions based on geography. Mm-hmm. So that was in effect in Canada until 2003. It was scrapped in 2003, and from 2003 until 2013 or so, there was no limit whatsoever on mm-hmm. mortgage insurance. And then it was capped at $1 million.
Right. So up until that time, the private mortgage, the like CMHC or financing for, or the insurance from Genworth, I guess it would be, really didn't matter if you were in a hot market in Vancouver, Toronto, or you were in, say, Moncton or St. John or something like that. The insurance premium was the same, even though the risks would be different.
Right. But the point is that you couldn't. So to put it in perspective, right now, the mortgage insurance cap is $1 million. Mm-hmm. In most markets in Canada, $1 million buys you a lot of house, a hell of a lot of house. Mm-hmm. Not so much in Toronto and Vancouver.
Right.
But even a place like Montreal, $1 million gets you a pretty nice house. Mm-hmm. And the goal of mortgage insurance was always to facilitate purchases at the entry level for first-time buyers. Mm-hmm. It was never to ensure that every person got access to a big house with granite and stainless steel, right?
Right.
It was always a needs versus want mentality.
Right.
And so the idea there was if you were in a more expensive market, you were allowed to buy a slightly more expensive home.
Sure.
Because it was representative of sort of the average home of that area. And a less expensive market, you were entitled to buy a less expensive home.
So that cap was a type of risk control.
It was. And I think more importantly, it gave them a macroprudential tool that they could selectively tighten and loosen various markets. And so what we have right now in Canada is a situation where you sure don't want to cool the market in Calgary because it's already pretty weak, right? You don't want to cool the market in Quebec or Eastern Canada. What you really want is some way to just put a chill on Toronto and Vancouver. But if you were to do something like increase the down payment across the board, it's going to hammer Calgary.
Right.
Right. It's going to be horrible for them. Mm-hmm. And so what they need at their disposal is some way to selectively tighten the screws at just those cities. And so one way they could do that is via a mortgage insurance cap. Mm-hmm. So they might say, in normal market times, we'll let you insure up to, $1 million in Toronto, but this market's getting a bit frothy. We're going to ratchet that down a bit or something like that. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know that's the perfect answer, but if CMHC is concerned about two markets, mm-hmm. then they need to focus on ways to cool those markets without having a major dampening effect
for everyone.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so what are the possible ramifications at this point? So we've identified there's really the two main markets that are cause for concern. Some people would say, well, you know what? We're starting to get concerned ourselves. We think that there will be long-term stagnation, right? Or a soft landing. Mm-hmm. You think that's a bit too optimistic? Because of course, the last major correction we saw, I don't think there's a lot of people saying right before it happened, there's going to be a major correction any day now. You kind of have to identify these things in hindsight. So what do you think is the possibility? Is it going to be a soft landing? Is it going to be a hard correction? Is it more of the same for a few more years?
Well, I mean, look, you have to weight those by probability, right? Because none of those are a zero probability. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could be here 10 years from now talking about an ongoing boom. It's out there. I mean, look, it's out there. I think that's slim, but I that's not outside the realm of possibility.
Sure.
We could look at something catastrophic or something in between. So look, I think the risk of a hard landing is high. And the reason for that, and again, hard landing, however you want to define that, but let's say a peak trough correction in prices nationally in excess of 20%. Mm-hmm. pretty devastating. I think that's high. So I don't know how exactly what that looks like, but let's call that like a, I don't know, a 40% chance, 50% chance, but it's up there. It's a non-trivial chance that that happens in the next few years. Certainly not 100, certainly not zero.
Right.
And the reason, again, I would get at that is one of the things I think people miss in a flat market is, again, you lose so many of these secondary benefits from a housing boom. So consumer spending slows by default, because one of the things that drives consumer spending is access to credit. So a good example is home equity lines of credit, okay, which have been, you know, they're a massive source of consumer debt in Canada.
Right.
And they've been used to finance, you know, purchases of toys and
conspicuous trips, consumption.
You got it in some cases. And banks aren't eager to expand those when prices are flat or slightly falling, right? They tend to tighten their underwriting. And so you lose that tailwind. And then generally you just get a blow to confidence. People don't feel as wealthy when their house isn't rising 20% a year.
Yeah.
And so it's a little less, it's harder to justify some of that extra spending.
I think it's been a while now, so I won't hold you to, or I wouldn't, if you forget, I wouldn't blame you, but the rate of growth of lines of credit and home equity lines of credit, mm-hmm. you put out a note about that a little while ago. Do you want to share some of your findings?
Sure. I think people will be surprised on this one. First of all, the rate of growth hasn't been that impressive in the last few years, because mm-hmm. what's happened is we've seen some regulatory changes governing those. And so they have had the effect of dampening the rate of growth. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the outstanding stock of home equity lines of credit in Canada, I mean, you're talking about 13% of GDP, mm-hmm. which, you know, that doesn't mean anything to people until I say that in the US at peak, it was 4%, right? So, you know, we often mock Americans. We say, oh, those crazy Americans borrowing off their homes as a, you know, an ATM and blasting it into the economy.
Yeah. We could teach them a thing or two.
Yeah, no kidding. So, you know, people need to be careful of that. And one of the concerns for me when I look at that is, if you understand the structure of that type of debt, it's revolving credit. Mm-hmm. It's callable at any point. Okay, so I just want to let your listeners let that sink in for a minute. Okay, mm-hmm. It's callable at any point. So you have a margin call waiting on you. So in a down market, one of the things that concerns me is, let's say that house prices actually started to fall, and let's say the banks got
that
nervous.
Can't happen.
I know. Let's envision a fairy tale.
Right. So this is all make believe at this point.
Yeah. Right. But let's say that in this imaginary Canada, house prices actually fell.
Yeah.
One of the things that lenders are likely to do is get pretty nervous on the highest loan to value bucket of those home equity lines of credit, mm-hmm. And they're probably going to force you at the very least to amortize it. So right now in Canada, most home equity lines of credit are interest only. Mm-hmm. So all you pay is the interest. You don't have to amortize it. So you don't have to pay it down, in other words. And if the banks get nervous, it's the first thing they're going to do is make them pay it down. Mm-hmm. And so what that looks like in practice is it's like a 5x jump in your monthly payment.
Right.
Right. That's assuming they don't just call the loan on you.
Right.
Which they're legally entitled to do. They could mm-hmm. tell you tomorrow, look, we want you to repay all of it, part of it, whatever. So that's a concern to me. I think it's likely that in a down market, we'll see those home equity lines credits act as a massive drag on consumer spending, because it's going to divert discretionary income to repaying that debt. And it's a sizable chunk of credit. That's one area that concerns me. The other area that concerns me is more in the private mortgage space, which is a very new I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. Private mortgage has been around forever, but it's really boomed in the last few years, again, partly related to regulatory tightening that's forced volume outside of the traditional banking system. Mm-hmm. And what that looks like in practice is it's either companies that pool money from investors and then lend on mortgages, or it's individuals who are paired directly on title, usually facilitated by a mortgage broker. So a wealthy individual, and then you've got a borrower on the other side that maybe their credit is impaired. They don't qualify to bank. And the mortgage broker pairs them, and they get a mortgage directly from a wealthy investor. Now, in Canada, these are all overwhelmingly one-year term mortgages, mm-hmm. interest only, mm-hmm. with absolutely no guarantee that mortgage gets extended beyond the 1 year.
Right.
So what, again, people need to understand that lending is highly reflexive. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what that means is, when the market is booming, lenders tend to get looser, right? So they tend to drop their underwriting standards because the underlying collateral is perceived as being safe.
Yep.
the opposite happens in a down market. And that's why you get these big cycles in credit, highly reflexive. And what we're going to end up seeing, I think, is in the next downturn, a lot of these private mortgage lenders who have often sourced their funding from mom and pop investors who are fairly skittish to begin with, these private mortgage lenders are going to tighten their underwriting. They're not going to renew.
Just for the people who are listening, when he says mix, it's not a racial slur. He's talking about mortgage investment corporations.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting a bit. we're a bit inside baseball here. Yeah. Okay, let me back up.
You know what? Some listeners say, "What did he just say?"
Yeah, I'm hearing myself talk, and I'm going, "No, this doesn't going to make sense to the averages." let me back up. So, a private lender again is just, you know, it can be either a pool of money run by a company that lends to individuals who either have very bad credit or can't prove their income. So they don't fit within the traditional box mm-hmm. for a mortgage.
So this is a mortgage investment corporation, a MIC.
A MIC, yeah. Right. A mortgage investment corporation. But it can also happen just between a wealthy individual
right.
who lends directly. So like I've got, you know, $100,000 sitting over here. Preet, hey, you can't get a mortgage from your bank. Maybe a mortgage broker facilitates it and I go directly on title on a loan that you take out to purchase a mm-hmm. home or to consolidate some debt.
Right. And I get to sleep with your wife.
Yeah. Hey, whatever works. hope she doesn't listen.
And I'm saying in general, I'm not saying, oh, okay. Yeah. Like this lender, this person is like, you know, here are the terms of the deal. You know, it's interest only. I get to move in. I get to.
You do almost get the firstborn child. Like right. they're
yes,
often
that's
highly
what I should
punitive.
Have said was that.
Well, listen, the reality is when you're dealing with 1 year terms from lenders that, these are not banks. They don't have reputational risk. They don't right. have to think about, geez, you know, what happens if we tick off our clients? They right. don't. They don't care.
Right.
And so the concern that I have is in the next cycle, they're going to tighten their underwriting. They're probably going to be refusing to renew a number of these mortgages mm-hmm. in the next downturn. And it's going to be extremely problematic for people. Right. You may remember if you've seen the movie, The Big Short.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Great book, by the way.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't do it justice. But at one point, you know, Steve Carell is talking to the stripper.
Oh, yes. Remember that?
And,
yes.
And he says, you're not going to be able to refinance your mortgage because they're tightening. They're going to tighten on you and you're not going to be able to refinance. And she says, like all four of them. Right.
Yeah.
You know, right? And look, the parallels aren't perfect here in Canada, but people need to understand that that's what a cycle looks like is lenders get tight. And stuff that you think you can refinance in an up market, you can't in a down market. And mm-hmm. the perfect example of that is these private mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So you just need to be extremely cautious. You know, people taking out a private mortgage, they need to recognize that a year from now, there's no obligation for them to renew. And if they don't renew, they're going to go power of sale on your ass. And you've got no recourse. They are going to sell your house. So, you know, that market dynamic concerns me a lot. It's something that I suspect regulators are going to start watching a lot closer.
Right. Yeah, it's the tightening of the credit cycle that's the scary part. I don't know. Have you ever seen that? It's this 30-minute video produced by Bridgewater Associates or Ray Dalio.
Yeah.
How I forget what it's called, the economic engine or whatnot. Yeah. And it basically talks about the credit super cycle and whatnot.
Absolutely.
It's a great video to sort of expand on what Ben's talking about. So if you want, take a look on YouTube or Google. Just do a Google search for Ray Dalio, the economic engine, I think it's called.
I think it's called the economic machine.
Economic machine, something like that. Video Ray Dalio. Anyways, yeah, you'll find it. I'll put a link on Twitter and whatnot as well, but it's pretty interesting. So one of my last questions for you, even though I could talk to you for hours on this stuff, is let's say that there is a correction in housing in both the Toronto and Vancouver markets.
Well, by the way, I just got to interrupt you here. I just looked up on my phone, How the Economic Machine Works by Ray Dalio.
There you go. How the Economic Machine Works by Ray Dalio. Thank you very much. Do you need a top up on your beer?
No, this is great, man.
Okay. Where was I?
If something happens.
Yes, if something happens.
Which we know it's not going to happen. But yeah, in the
let's
off chance
make believe. Later, you know, pretend. You know, we're writing a screenplay for a fictitious movie. And let's say that real estate goes down in value. What are the impacts at this point? Because it has been a super cycle, real estate bull market, for a very long period of time. So we've seen lots of gains. And because of that, that's attracted more and more people into real estate related industries, whether it be realtors, mortgage brokers, construction, people who do renovations, you name it. There have been a lot more people now involved in those industries because of this long-term boom in housing. So if there is a correction at this point, what are the potential impacts? Could that put the country into a recession?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You hear a lot about supply chains these days, because if the past couple years have taught us anything, it's that an efficient, well-managed supply chain is absolutely critical to keeping businesses successful and consumers happy. I'm Will Haywood, and I host a podcast called All Business, No Boundaries, where we talk about supply chains, how they work, what happens when they don't, and the innovations that are redefining what's possible in the world of logistics. Join me for insightful interviews with thought leaders and industry experts. We discuss how optimizing supply chains can break down the barriers that are holding businesses back. That's All Business, No Boundaries by DHL Supply Chain. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, my view on this is very different than most people. I think most people would view it as you need a recession to trigger a downturn in prices.
Right.
I think often that's the case if you get some sort of an exogenous shock. So out in Calgary, clearly oil has driven the weakness in the economy, and that in turn is leading to a pretty stagnant real estate market. Mm-hmm. That is one way that these cycles play out. But it's not the only way. And to your point, we could just end up with a scenario where we have exhausted our capacity to lever growth off of this housing market. And it's a slowdown in residential investment. It's a slowdown in housing related spending that becomes the driver of the economic weakness, right? And that's a plausible scenario. I mean, I think a lot of people disagree with me, but when you start parsing the composition of GDP growth in this country and employment growth, it's hard not to see very quickly that a lot of this has been driven off the real estate market. And so it's a chicken versus egg scenario. Look, it's going to be a correction in real estate is devastating.
Right.
It's just devastating. It affects everyone, affects your consumer spending. It hits what is typically the largest asset in most household balance sheets. It's devastating. And, you know, there are a number of companies that have exposure to this market that are going to get hit as well, should something like this materialize. So, the short answer is, it's a very bad scenario, any sort of a downturn. And I don't know that it has to be an exogenous shock. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if this market literally, you know, implodes under its own weight. And then we years later go and try to attach a catalyst to that downturn.
I think whatever ends up happening, it is going to be well studied.
Yeah. And you know what, to that point, if we look at the US market, if I were to ask you, hey, what caused the US housing crisis? Right. And then after the fact, people say, oh, well, there's lots of subprime lending, et cetera, et cetera. But if house prices hadn't stagnated, if house prices hadn't started going sideways in 2005, all of those 228 mortgages, which were all those toxic reset mortgages that end up blowing up, those wouldn't have been a problem,
right?
Because all of those borrowers could have refinanced in more favorable terms. Mm-hmm. So what actually caused the catastrophe in the US is not the borrowing itself. It's the flattening in prices that caused that credit to season and ultimately go delinquent.
Yeah. And it's kind of similar with Bernie Madoff, right? It wasn't until prices of securities started to go down that he could no longer keep up that Ponzi scheme that he was running. But had that not had happened, it would have continued to this day, right?
Right.
So it was something that had to happen before sort of people sort of realize, hey, what? Not that I'm saying housing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hear what you're saying, but that's the reality is that in these markets, sometimes the catalyst for the downturn can simply be a softening in prices,
right?
Which has all sorts of unintended economic consequences.
Yeah.
And then often, you know, I think a lot of these asset bubbles, you know, if that's what we're looking at in Canada, they tend to implode under their own weight. And like I said, it's literally you wake up one day and liquidity in the market's down for whatever reason. It's like someone rang a silent bell and buyers have disappeared. And then later we go looking for the reason why. And it could be something as simple as just a small shift in psychology.
Yeah. And certainly we can't, I don't believe we can call the short term. We don't know if, you know, prices have legs to keep on running for a few more years. I think you would agree that that is possible.
Absolutely.
But it has now become forefront for the policymakers. It is certainly on the minds of younger Canadians, millennials who are straddled with more debt than ever, job prospects, not that strong as maybe they have been in the past. And house prices are very high, and they've got a generation above them saying, yeah, listen, housing is the way to go because it'll work for our generation.
Buy now or be priced out forever, right?
Right. So a lot of people have the question, if you are a first-time prospective home buyer, what do you do in these two hot markets? Ben, please give everyone
that's
the
a
answer.
Terrible question. Let me gaze into my crystal ball for a moment. I mean, look, first of all, I would say I do not give blanket advice. And you can look back at anything I've ever said in the public, and you know, there's never a blanket buy sell recommendation.
Yep.
First of all, I think it depends largely on your personal financial circumstance. I'm not against real estate ownership. I own real estate myself, which a lot of people find surprising, but I'm not against the idea of ownership. What I would say is in a market like this, and again, as it relates to the single family market in a place like Toronto, there are some different dynamics there than what you might find in the condo market. So for example, it's not always easy to find a good single family rental in Toronto.
Right.
Right. And so your options, your buy versus rent options are often limited. That's really not the case in the condo market. And so I would say, you know, if you're a first time buyer, you don't have kids, so you're not worried about, you know, having to change school districts or having to move mid-year or something really traumatic for kids. I don't really see why you would buy at this point. Mm-hmm. Now, again, we could have had this discussion a couple of years ago and I would have said the same thing, and the market's gone up a bit,
right,
in the condo market. But when you start looking at the cost of owning versus renting a comparable unit, the economics there really are tilted towards renting and just pocketing the difference.
And full disclosure, I'm a renter in a Toronto condo.
That's great. And beautiful condo, by the way. You got a great view here.
Thanks, man. I mean, I looked at the price versus the rent. And at the time, the particular price to rent ratio was somewhere around 275 in terms of the price versus monthly rent. And versus the long-term norms, this seemed to be way off. And when I looked at the breakdown of carrying the property, if I was to own it, maintenance fees, property taxes versus renting, the difference was so big to me that I thought, okay, at this point in time, because I'm a somewhat decent investor, I've got some knowledge there, I thought, okay, with that difference, what could grow faster? The value of this place, which may be closer to a peak than a trough.
Or your Tesla stock options.
Right, yeah. No one knows about that. My investments in general, index funds. So my main investments are next. But what Ben referenced to, what we talked about earlier in the before we started the podcast was, yes, my small trading account, I take some flyers just to scratch the itch of investing. But the bulk of my investments are indexed in a couch potato style. I did well with Tesla call options in March. Anyways, so at that point in time, I thought, all right, well, I could take the difference and invest it. And I just had more confidence at that point in time, especially because I didn't know if I want to put down roots. So again, one of these variables is, are you going to stay here for a long time? Mm-hmm. If not, don't even think about it in the Toronto condo market is what I would say. And so when you put all those variables together, it made more sense for us to be a renter and to grow our equity, our net worth in different ways. And so far that's worked. But I don't know if that's always going to be the case for your typical first-time home buyer or what have you.
Right. Well, look, I would say that at this point in the cycle, leverage gets increasingly dangerous.
Yes.
We're pretty close to the bottom in rates. There's not a lot lower that rates can conceivably go. And this is from a guy, by the way, there's a lot of people out there have been calling for rising mortgage rates for a long time. That's not this guy. Mm-hmm. I've been consistently saying rates are going to go lower. I was probably one of the few people saying back in 2012, 2013, that the next move by the Bank of Canada is going to be a cut.
I remember that.
And here we are. And so
what's your next call?
I think they're going to cut again.
Yeah.
You know, but look, at the end of the day, it gets a bit more complicated at this point because you've got an increasingly challenging regulatory regime in Canada as it relates to the banks. And so they're levying additional costs onto the banks.
Right.
And so even though rates may come down from the Bank of Canada and you may see bond yields come down a bit, I don't know that you're going to see the full pricing effect to the consumer. So I think, I don't mind saying that I think we're very close to the bottom in mortgage rates.
Yeah.
And so look, rates at leverage at this point in the cycle can be exceptionally dangerous. So if you're thinking of buying with 5% down or 10% down in a condo, I think you're crazy at this point. Sure, you may make some spectacular leveraged returns, but you're risking a lot to get that at this point. I think far more prudent, especially if you're young, you're not, you know, you don't have kids tying you down. You may not be totally attached to the city. You may want to pursue other career options. I mean, look at renting. It's a great alternative. Again, that discussion gets a lot more nuanced when you throw kids into the picture.
Sure.
I've been there and I've rented with kids and I've thought, geez, getting notice from your tenant that they're selling the house and you've got to move with, a couple of kids. It just sucks. So,
and
it's not always easy to find good single family accommodations. So, I don't discount that in any way. I think that's certainly factored into the equation. It's one of the reasons why I bought, begrudgingly. Mm-hmm. but be that as it may. So I think everyone needs to make an informed decision on this. I think we're very late in this cycle. People need to remember that real estate is cyclical. And buying near the top has incredibly traumatic effects. And I think at this point, the risks associated with buying, especially in the condo space where there's so many good rental options, it's just hard to justify for most, young people.
Right. And there are a lot of rental options in Toronto. I mean, there have been a lot of people who have been going to various workshops and seminars and saying, hey, you should buy this condo and rent it out. And so there's a lot of rental units available because we haven't had apartment buildings built in a long time.
That's changing.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah.
Big time. So we're going to see a big influx in purpose-built rental apartments in the next, it's not going to be immediately, but over the next few years.
Yeah, because it was a decade since the last one. And so what took the place of that was individual condo owners who became landlords as opposed to one entity running an entire building as a rental. Anyways, so we've got tons of material. We could do a full second podcast. We're coming up to an hour, right? About 50 minutes. So the time flies when I'm talking to someone as enjoyable and as knowledgeable as yourself. And at the end of every podcast, I give the guests, you've got a minute, 2 minutes, whatever you want to give a commercial of your company, whatever you want to talk about. The floor is yours, my friend.
I can't really give a plug on my company. I'm pretty restricted in terms of what I, who I can have on my distribution list. But I don't know, man. I think we're at the point in the cycle where people need to really think independently. I think that the young people listening to the podcast, your parents love you, they mean well, but oftentimes their experience with real estate is biased, right? They remember an awful lot of gains and they often don't remember the 10 years of flat or declining markets like we saw in the late 80s and early 90s. So just be mindful of that. Parents mean well. I think they often pressure kids into making decisions that, hey, look, they've been great decisions so far, but again, being mindful that real estate is cyclical and we're late in the cycle. Mm-hmm. That's one big thing. The other thing is, when I think about the market, again, getting back to what we talked about a little earlier about how bad could it be? One of the things that concerns me is when we look at,
that's my girlfriend just, come on in, sweetie, come on in, baby. It's all right. Sorry. That's okay.
So when we look at the dynamics in the market, now relative to the late 80s when we had the last major cycle, we have more household indebtedness.
Yes.
We've got, one of the things people don't realize is when, everyone remembers high interest rates in the late 80s. What they forget is when the market peaked in 1989 until 1994, the Bank of Canada cut the overnight rate by 1,000 basis points. So they cut it from 14% down to 4%.
Yeah.
And in that time, prices still fell 25%.
Wow.
And so when you think about what the conventional monetary policy options are in Canada to put some sort of a floor under housing in the next cycle,
yeah,
I mean, there's nothing.
Right.
There's literally nothing. I mean, there's nothing that we have at our disposal without engaging in highly unconventional monetary policy and decimating the currency.
Right.
And so, that's an enormous concern. People forget how few bullets are left there at the central banks. And the other thing is when you look at the composition of the economy, we've never had this many people employed in construction. We've never had this much of our economic growth levered off of the housing boom itself. When you throw all those things in the pot, I think it makes a compelling case that the next cycle, whenever it is, and it could be tomorrow, it could be next year, it could be 5 years from now. I have no idea when it's going to be.
Right.
But this next cycle is probably going to be one for the books.
Oh, man. What a great note to leave it on, Dr. Doom. all right. Ben, thank you so much for being on the show. And to my faithful listeners, if you enjoyed this episode or the podcast in general, Don't forget to head over to iTunes to leave a rating. It really literally takes a few seconds, but it means a lot for the show, and it helps me to secure great guests like Ben. That's it for today. We will see you next time.